ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Goodness. All right. How are you today?
Here we are. I'm very well. Yeah, I'm well. How about you?
I'm good.
This is someone that we are going to call Jane.
All right. Do you want to just tell me your story then? What happened with your son? Let's start there.
It began back in, I think it was between the two lockdowns during COVID, and he had broken up with a long-term girlfriend and was feeling pretty low, so moved in with me, kind of seemed to be getting things back on track. But he was listening to and really, I could tell, being very influenced by the Josh Rogan. Is that his
Joe
name?
Joe Rogan,
I beg your pardon. And by all accounts, Joe Rogan was getting into some pretty wacky COVID theories. And, he thought this guy was great. So it started off fairly low key, but then that really started to ramp up. He started to post things online on Facebook that were derived from QAnon. Things about the end of the world.
Pizzagate.
Oh, wow. And the whole pedophile ring conspiracy.
All sorts of things that are really very strange.
So fairly deep down that rabbit hole.
4 years later, Jane's son is still firmly deep down that rabbit hole.
I don't have huge hope. I can't see a way at the moment, but I am hopeful that eventually he'll be able to come out of it.
And while his descent was pretty textbook, as in the risk factors that can lead someone down the conspiracy road are well documented, and he ticked a few of those boxes, Jane's question now is, where is the textbook for getting him out?
I mean, I know how people come to believe in these things. I think there's been quite a bit of research.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in what happens to people once they've gone down that rabbit hole, you know? What's the prognosis, essentially?
So we are going to try and find an answer to that with the help of two people who have a whole lot of expertise in this area, but they come to the subject matter from different angles.
I'm Brent Lee. I am a former conspiracist of 15 years.
My name is Karen Douglas, and I'm a professor of social psychology at the University of Kent.
I'm now the host of Some Dare Call It Conspiracy podcast.
My main area of research is on the psychology of conspiracy theories.
2018 is when I finally walked away from it all.
It seems I'm getting a lot of these emails from people now. Like, what do I do? I've lost this person. How do I get them back?
Today, what does it take for a person to stop believing in conspiracy theories? Can you really change their mind? And what made Brent Lee change his mind? I'm Sana Qadar. This is All in the Mind. Everything sort of reached a crescendo for Jane and her son on Boxing Day 2 years ago when they had a big blow up.
And I might have made a throwaway remark about, are your vaccines up to date? Or like just something in passing. I can't remember exactly how it started. But it kind of went downhill from there. And I said, you know, have a look at the science for this. And then he arced up about science and the whole culture of science and how it's cooked up by the elites to control people rather than being peer reviewed and, you know, all the kind of thorough process that anything that gets published has to go through before it's ever published. And in the end, he just walked out. I went after him and kind of made up. But yeah, it was pretty shocking, I've got to say. It was pretty full on.
God, that must have been really upsetting.
Yeah, it was fairly upsetting. And yeah, really quite confronting that he just could not see what to my mind seemed fairly reasonable.
In a previous life, Jane was a university academic. So research and evidence-based policy, that was all her area.
So this was a bit of a way to, I think, react against me. Nothing that I could suggest was right because I stood for the kind of suspicious elite that he's railing against.
And so now, their relationship consists of sporadic text messages and, on the rare occasion, a coffee or a meal.
It's just been a fairly tense relationship ever since. And so I tend to see him on neutral ground. That seems to be the safest way.
What was he like before all of this?
He was actually quite a generous, kind, socially conscious person. Mm-hmm. He was always not particularly confident and then covered that with a bit of bravado.
Mm-hmm.
But he did maintain contact with family and friends, and that has all dropped away. Primarily, right. I think, because he is embarrassed. He knows that people will find his views very strange and may question him on it, and he just doesn't want to stand up to that sort of critique.
I don't know Jane's son's version of the story, like how he would explain what's been going on for him, but this is a story that's played out amongst countless families in recent years, to devastating effect.
It seems I'm getting a lot of these emails from people now, like, what do I do? How do I get this person back? I've lost this person. How do I get them back? So I think since I started working on this topic 15 years ago, it wasn't such a thing. I didn't get emails from people asking me to help them with their personal situations, whereas now I do.
This is social psychologist Professor Karen Douglas from the University of Kent.
It's actually really quite difficult to respond to those messages because I'm not a therapist. I'm not that kind of psychologist. I'm just an academic psychologist. So I can kind of talk to people a lot about why conspiracy theories might be interesting to people, why they might be popular right now, and what some of their consequences are.
And so one of the main things she tries to explain is the psychological needs or motivations that are behind a lot of these kinds of beliefs. And there are three main ones that her research has identified. But like I said before, there has been a fair amount of coverage of this kind of thing in recent years. But we will do a quick recap here, because if you've lost a loved one to conspiracy beliefs, understanding these motivations will help you better understand them and hopefully better help them. So, the first motivation is a desire for certainty and knowledge.
People don't really want to feel uncertain. They want to know what's actually happened. And certain kind of thinking styles tend to attract people more to conspiracy theories as well. So people who want to find closure, like to quickly find closure on a topic, will often seize on conspiracy theories because they can say, okay, it was all the government. That's the end of the story. They did it. I don't need to look any further.
The second set of motives are existential motives.
What that means is that people are looking generally in their lives to have safety and security and to have control and autonomy over the things that are happening to them. And so when something important happens and people are looking for an explanation, they're kind of informed by these sorts of needs as well. Like, how do I regain a sense of power? How do I try and regain a sense of control over the things that are happening to me?
And so she says people who are anxious can be more attracted to conspiracy theories.
People who are, you know, feeling less secure about things that are going on in their lives, so they're trying to kind of, I guess, claw back a sense of power and control.
Now, the final set of motivations that can underpin a lot of conspiracy beliefs, according to Karen's research, are social needs.
By that we mean that people generally want to feel good about themselves as individuals, and people also want to feel good about the groups that they belong to, and conspiracy theories might seem appealing as a way to do that, achieve those sorts of motives, because if you kind of have the idea that there is another group out there that's conspiring, doing all of these terrible things, then you might think you're not doing these things and my group isn't doing these terrible things. So it might feel to be a way that you can kind of feel good about yourself and feel good about the groups that you belong to.
Then there are a few extra factors that are worth considering. One is narcissism. Karen says people who are narcissistic or have a high need for feeling unique tend to be more attracted to conspiracies.
And I guess the argument there is that if people feel that they have access to scarce or hidden information that other people don't have, then they can feel unique compared to those other people and a little bit superior. And this also happens at the level of groups. So there's a construct that we call in social psychology collective narcissism. So that is people who feel that the groups that they belong to are superior and better than other groups and don't receive recognition that they should be getting from other people.
And then, in general, times of crisis can also make people more vulnerable to conspiracies, and people who are feeling socially isolated and lonely can be more at risk, too. So when you think of Jane's son, who is going through a breakup during a global pandemic, you can understand why he might have started to gravitate towards conspiratorial thinking. At least, that's how Jane has been making sense of his behaviour.
I think it happened because of the huge kind of shock that came with COVID that everyone experienced. You know, it was a paradigm shift. So I think he was caught up with that and felt very powerless. And it was probably for the first time in his life that he'd experienced that, coupled with breaking up with his girlfriend, who he probably saw a long-term life with. And yeah, so I think those two things probably put him in a kind of second adolescence,
right,
in a way, that he felt he had to reimagine himself and find an identity. And this was a ready-made identity with, you know, people who were going to welcome him.
So this brings us back to the question of how to pull someone like her son out of the rabbit hole. Can anything be done? What, as Jane said, is the prognosis?
As far as I can see, it's not great. I'm struggling to see a way back.
So we asked Karen, the social psychology professor from the University of Kent, and she said, unsurprisingly, it's hard to give a straight answer on that.
Because it is such an individual thing. I guess one thing I would say is that it is challenging. It is not easy, because once people do believe very strongly in a conspiracy theory, or anything for that matter, once people have a very strong conviction about something, it's difficult to change their minds, because any challenge to those beliefs might be seen as a kind of challenge to them personally and how they live their lives. So it's very, very, very difficult. And also, they will often be able to come up with ways to deal with information that's contrary to their belief. So they will look for information that confirms their belief rather than information that disconfirms it. They'll dismiss that kind of information. And I guess an important thing to remember as well is that for a lot of people who believe strongly in conspiracy theories, they're not very interested in getting out of that. They enjoy conspiracy theories. They find them interesting. They find them important. These are people who want to know the truth. They want to know the facts. So they're not necessarily going to be very receptive to individuals who come along and say, we need to get you out of this way of thinking. So for anybody who is in a relationship or kind of wanting to confront somebody who believes in conspiracy theories, they have that immediate barrier in front of them. This person just might not want to be rescued.
That is a pretty tough pill to swallow. And the other problem is, there just isn't a whole lot of research on what factors can lead someone to stop believing in conspiracies. It's just such a new field of research, and most of the work that is being done is pointing towards prevention as the best strategy anyways. So like educating people on how to recognize bad evidence or warning them of specific theories beforehand. As for what to do afterwards, the advice is generally maintain contact. Don't ridicule the person. Don't be hostile. Let them know you're interested and care. Keep that dialogue going. So in the absence of more firm research on what factors can lead people to change their minds on conspiracy beliefs, we're going to have to go with anecdote.
I work in the factory, so...
And Brent Lee has one hell of an anecdote. He was a hardcore believer in all kinds of conspiracies for 15 years before walking away altogether. And so to understand how he managed to change his mind, you have to understand how he made up his mind in the first place.
So it all starts really for me in 2003, when we're on the cusp of war in Iraq. I kept hearing a lot about the weapons of mass destruction lie, and I was very, very anti-war at the time, and I happened to come across some 9/11 conspiracy theory documentaries on the internet. When I watched these videos, I was straight away hooked on them.
Were these videos about 9/11 being an inside job? Is that what they were?
Yes, they were. They were 9/11 was an inside job perpetuated by the Bush administration and certain intelligence agencies. And just the way that they framed these arguments and framed the footage, and it was very convincing.
From 9/11 conspiracy theories, Brent started looking into secret societies like the Freemasons and Yale's Skull and Bone Society.
I started to come to a conclusion that it was a network of secret societies and cults that were actually controlling events around the world, like terror attacks or mass shootings. They were done ritualistically, and they were some sort of magic ceremony.
Gosh.
That was to put a black magic spell on the populace so that we couldn't see through the facade.
And what, to your mind at the time, was on the other side of the facade? What were they hiding?
Who was really in charge? And that most of these things were orchestrated. They didn't happen by chance.
And why was it more appealing or more reasonable to believe that these were all connected events, this was a conspiracy, as opposed to events happening that then lead to other events? You know, like it's not top down, but bottom up.
Yeah, or like a domino effect. Mm. Coming out of it, I do think that it must be based in the idea that if we have someone to blame for these things, as opposed to them sort of happening by chance, or with 9/11, I think 9/11 is a really good one to always come back to, because it was hard to understand or fathom the idea that 19 hijackers could get past America's defense, that they could hijack 4 planes and crash them into their intended targets without the biggest military in the world at the time not knowing, or the largest intelligence network not actually being able to stop these people. And I think you just don't want to believe that that could happen, because these people are supposed to be the ones that are supposed to take care of you. And if they let that slip, like, that to me was unfathomable. Hmm. So they must have done it instead.
When you hear it put like that, you can start to understand the appeal of that particular conspiracy theory. But in 2012, the first cracks in Brent's beliefs started to appear.
I had to look at it retrospectively to try and figure out where that journey out began. And I think the most important part for me is the events around Sandy Hook.
Sandy Hook. This has to be one of the most awful chapters in the story of how conspiracy theories have evolved over the last couple of decades.
There's been another mass shooting in the United States.
If you're not familiar, Sandy Hook refers to a mass shooting at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012.
The first calls came in about 9:30 in the morning.
20-year-old Adam Lanza shot and killed 20 first graders, so 6 and 7-year-olds, alongside 6 adults. It was an entire classroom of children gone.
And one of the narratives that started popping up in the conspiracy movement was that these were hoaxes. Everyone involved was a crisis actor. And to me, that didn't gel with what I had been thinking for the previous 8-plus years. You know, I had been thinking that these were rituals, these were sacrifices.
Mm.
So now when everyone's saying that this didn't actually happen, well, what's the point in getting angry about this? Like, if no one dies, why do I care? And at that point, from 2012, 2015, every single terror attack, every single mass shooting, the main narrative in the movement was that these are all hoaxes, these are all crisis actors. And I thought, well, you guys can all think what you want to think, but I'm going off this way because I think it's still rituals. I think it's still sacrifices.
So you didn't not believe entirely. You just believed a different conspiracy than the mainstream one.
Yeah, totally. And I think that was me kind of pulling myself away from the community. And I think that's really important, because that means I didn't need to comply with what the rest of the community was saying, you know, so I was able to be a little bit more isolated from everyone else's control.
The next few years just accelerated Brent's alienation and confusion. You see, he thought democracy was a facade. Elections were all rigged, and so voting didn't matter. The outcome was already predetermined. But then something curious happened. Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump.
I thought she had been selected for like the previous 10 years, and it didn't happen.
And then when Trump started pushing deep state conspiracies himself, that was even more confusing to Brent, because these kinds of things operate in the shadows. If they're espoused by the president of the U.S., are they just mainstream now?
And that he even used them to get the votes. And this is what I could see. Because we're so connected through social media now, I could actually see democracy in action. I could see people changing their minds. And it was the exact same thing with the Brexit vote for me. that also didn't gel, because the whole point of this global conspiracy or this grand conspiracy was a new world order, a one world government. And breaking up the EU was not on the cards, really, because the EU is supposed to be the stepping stone to the New World Order.
Right.
And it really confused me. 2015 to 2018 was a very confusing time for me. In 2018, I'm scrolling through Facebook and I keep seeing lots of my friends posting more and more outrageous kind of conspiracy theories, like going down the flat earth rabbit hole. I was so confused that I just thought, right, I'm going to log off of this. And I logged off of Facebook and I didn't go back on for 3 years.
Oh, wow.
And during that whole time is when I started to try and figure it all out. Like, where did this come from? Where did these ideas come from? Like, is 9/11 an inside job or is it not? Let me go have a look. And what I found was that there's so much more counter information today than there was when I first fell down the rabbit hole. Even about conspiracy theories, where did they come from? Why do we believe them? And that's what really helped pull me out completely.
What was it, that process like, to emerge from this 15-year-long belief and start to question everything? That's got to be really destabilizing and confusing, like you said. Can you talk me through the emotional repercussions of leaving these beliefs behind?
It was very isolating because I had no longer had this online community that I had been building for over a decade. Pulling myself away from all of them was like very, very isolating and heartbreaking, to be honest, to just think that everything I thought was going on was actually not going on and kind of a figment of my imagination. But also, I didn't do any of the things that normal adults like do, because I thought the New World Order was coming to get me. And there's pretty much no need to chase a career, no need to get a mortgage, have kids, or any of this kind of thing. And that's, to me, that's why I feel like I lost most. But I've always been someone who doesn't mind like testing what I believe and living on the fringe, really. So after the isolation, after the confusion and starting to kind of rebuild my foundation, I started becoming a lot more energized about it.
That's eventually what led Brent to create his podcast, Some Dare Call It Conspiracy, where he and his co-host explain various theories and then dismantle them piece by piece.
To be fair, everything that I've gone through made me who I am today. I'm incredibly proud of myself, having the courage to actually question my own beliefs, question what I've been told. I don't have those things I was just saying I missed out on, but I'm happy I've got my podcast. I'm helping people. I'm explaining what this world was like, what this mindset was like, and it's helping a lot of people. So I'm very, very happy with where I'm at today.
And through his podcast, Brent has met a whole lot of other people who've stopped believing in conspiracy theories as well. And he says there's one thing they tend to share in common.
Yeah, there's definitely always a moment that doesn't match their beliefs. Like, say with me, it was like the politics. And I have a friend now who was a Sandy Hook denier. So she believed it was a hoax. All of the children, all of the adults, parents, everyone involved was a crisis actor. She started to work at a morgue and she realized how hard it was to fake death certificates.
Wow.
And that was something where she was like, oh, they couldn't fake these deaths then, like that many. So it was something that really just stopped her and she was like, that's not how the world works.
Okay, so at some point for people who stop believing, something slams up against their beliefs that just is impossible to ignore. That's generally how you found people leave.
That's definitely what I see a lot.
Given Brent's experience, I wanted to ask him about Jane and her son and find out what he would say to her, especially on her question of whether her son might someday stop believing.
I would definitely say people can come out. Look at me, like 15 years in, I had to do the work myself, but I was so deep down there probably believe most of the same things that he does. And one of the reasons why I started speaking out was to say, like, don't give up hope, because if I can do it, as far down as I was, almost anyone can.
He says the best thing she can do, that anyone can do who's lost someone they love to conspiracies, is to just keep talking. Like the research says, keep the relationship going, so if they ever do stop believing, they know they have supports around.
So what I've really tried to do is focus on giving friends and family like those tools to do that. And if you can remind them that, hey, I'm not trying to have an argument with you. I want you to know, like, we love each other. We respect each other. We've known each other all our lives. Like, let's try and figure this out together, because maybe you've got some answers that I don't have, and maybe I've got some that you don't have. Like, let's have a decent conversation.
But ultimately, do you feel like a person kind of just has to go on their own journey? Like, could anyone have said anything to you that would have made you change your mind or start to change your mind when you were deep in your beliefs?
That's a philosophical question. But I do think, I do think if I was still a conspiracist today and I came across myself and Neil Sanders, like my co-host, I would be very intrigued about what they had to say. And I would probably listen, probably get mad, but I'd probably have to listen. Then I'd have to research and then fact check and see if they were right. It is partly like a personal journey, because, you know, you convince yourself, essentially. Someone gives you the information and you convince yourself whether it's right or if it's wrong. But you can, like, hold someone's hand along the way.
Right.
I always liken it to a Jenga tower. You got to pull out one block, put it back on the top. Pull out another block, put it on the top. And slowly just keep pulling out all these blocks until the whole thing finally collapses.
So no real answers on a timeline or a prognosis. Hope is what people like Jane have to have, and a whole lot of patience. Do you worry about the future of your relationship with him?
I mean, it's not ideal that it continues like this. It would be nicer to have a closer relationship. Right. We've never been, since he's grown up and moved out of home, he's always been very independent. So he hasn't ever lived in my pocket.
Right.
However, it would be nice to know that we could meet and there aren't any taboo subjects. And he knows I don't agree with his beliefs, and he just has to sit with that.
Does he care?
Yeah, he does care. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, he loves me very deeply. So he would care very much. But, yeah, I think the only thing I can do at this stage is maintain that contact in a way that he's comfortable with, so that he doesn't disappear completely. And, you know, just hope that that is enough.
That is All in the Mind for this week. If you know anyone who's in a similar situation to Jane, who you think could benefit from hearing this episode, please consider sharing it with them. I want to say a big thank you to Professor Karen Douglas from the University of Kent, and to Brent Lee, former conspiracy theorist and host of the podcast Some Dare Call It Conspiracy, as well as a big thank you to Jane for sharing her story. We also spoke to a bunch of experts as part of the research for this episode who didn't end up in the final edit. So an additional thanks to Dr. Peter Ellerton, Dr. Matthew Marks, and Dr. Daniel Jolie. Thanks also to our producer, Rose Kerr, and sound engineer, Tegan Nichols. I'm Sana Qajar. Thank you for listening. I will catch you next time.
Hey ladies, it's your bestie Yumi Steins here. Hey, are you ready for a steamy new season of Ladies We Need to Talk? Because I sure as hell am. Now listen, if you've been living off-grid for the past decade and you're like, excuse me, who are you? Ladies We Need to what? Let me fill you in. Ladies We Need to Talk is a podcast that is hugely popular that you need to get on board with, and it's all about breaking taboos around sex, health, and relationships. We basically get down and dirty dissecting all the stuff that you and your girl clique talk about when you think no one else is listening. We'll be meeting women who are horny with a capital H. These hot as hell ladies are thirsty for orgasms, and frankly, we are here for it.
The room stopped spinning and everything was sexy. everything. Chairs, clouds, the kitchen counter, and I just wanted to hump everything.
We're going to be catching up with ladies who are grappling with a period that's gone missing in action and a bewildering PCOS diagnosis.
I just kind of thought, well, I'm broken. There's something seriously damaged in my body that I'm not getting my period.
And this season, for the first time ever, I will be your hottest, coolest agony auntie, answering questions from you, my devoted listeners, dishing out no-holds-barred advice on everything from partners whose trackies are permanently glued to their bodies to the way that our own bodies betray us as we age.
I had a prolapse kind of appear. It's gross and I have to, like, push it in sometimes. And the other thing is that my, like, labia, it flaps. I can hear it when I walk.
I can't wait to hang out with you. So subscribe to Ladies We Need to Talk wherever you listen to your podcasts or find us on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.